Stand at the edge of a cliff and watch the sunset. Physics can tell you why the sky turns orange, light scattering through atmospheric particles. Biology explains why your heart rate slows as you relax. Neuroscience maps the dopamine release in your brain. But none of these answers the question that actually matters. Why does this moment feel sacred? Why does beauty pierce us? Why do we sense we're standing before something that demands reverence rather than measurement? We've become experts at explaining everything and understanding nothing. Evolutionary psychology has become our era's favorite hammer, and suddenly every human experience looks like a nail. Religion? Just a survival strategy for group cohesion. Art? A peacock's tail for attracting mates. Love? Chemical reactions optimizing reproductive success. Morality? Social contracts disguised as universal truths. This reductionist impulse promises to demystify human existence, yet it creates a peculiar paradox. If our brains evolved merely for survival rather than truth, why should we trust evolutionary theory itself? Here's the central insight. We can understand the world in two complete yet incompatible ways. Science explains through causes, tracking physical processes, identifying mechanisms, predicting outcomes. Personal understanding interprets through reasons, grasping intentions, recognizing meanings, appreciating purposes. Neither perspective is wrong. They're simply incommensurable, like trying to see both the duck and the rabbit in that famous optical illusion simultaneously. This isn't metaphysical dualism, the claim that minds and bodies are separate substances. It's cognitive dualism, one reality, two ways of knowing. Consider mathematics. We prove theorems about infinite sequences and grasp necessary truths extending infinitely beyond survival needs. No early human required calculus to hunt successfully. Yet we understand abstract concepts with zero survival value, suggesting our minds reach beyond mere adaptation into realms of pure truth. Language reveals the same pattern. Human language distinguishes truth from falsehood, positioning us at nature's edge rather than immersed within it. We create poetry serving no reproductive purpose and debate philosophical questions irrelevant to survival. A bird song attracts a mate, but Shakespeare's sonnets make meaning visible. Then there's altruism. Unlike instinctive helping in other species, human moral action involves complex judgment. We help strangers we'll never see again and sacrifice our interests for abstract principles. This isn't reciprocal altruism or kin selection. It points toward a realm where persons recognize other persons as worthy of care simply because they exist. What makes something sacred? It's not just being forbidden or set apart. Sacred objects exist simultaneously within our ordinary world and beyond it, like doorways between the mundane and transcendent. Consider the difference between a building and a cathedral, a meal and the Eucharist, cloth and a prayer shawl worn by generations. The physical materials remain identical, yet something transforms them into passages between realms. Profanation treats sacred things as merely ordinary, using a Torah scroll as scratch paper, turning a church into a warehouse. Desecration goes further, deliberately reducing the sacred to its degraded opposite. When conquerors destroy temples, they're attempting to prove the divine has abandoned its people. René Girard noticed that monotheistic faiths promise peace, yet remain entangled with conflict. His insight? Religion isn't the cause of violence, but its solution. Primeval societies were trapped in cycles of mimetic desire, everyone wanting what their rivals possessed, creating endless revenge spirals. The breakthrough came through scapegoating, identifying an outsider who could absorb communal violence without triggering further vengeance. Christianity is unique because Jesus, the innocent victim, understood the necessity of his death and forgave his killers. The Eucharist rehearses this self-sacrifice, transforming conflict into reconciliation. When you look at someone you love, science describes light reflecting off skin, triggering recognition patterns. But you're not seeing physical features. You're encountering another consciousness looking back. The face exists simultaneously in the objective world of flesh and the subjective realm of meaning. A smile isn't muscle contraction. It's an involuntary revelation of soul that cannot be faked. When lovers gaze into each other's eyes, they're seeking the other's subjectivity, that impossible-to-locate perspective appearing in physical space. Consider the blush. You cannot decide to blush, yet it happens when another's gaze crosses your inner threshold, a recognition of mutual subjectivity, an acknowledgement that you've been seen as a person, not an object. The face symbolizes our persistent individuality. Despite constant physical changes, something remains constant. Theatrical masks work powerfully because by removing human flesh, they paradoxically reveal character more clearly, concentrating essence rather than hiding it. From the physical world emerges the life world of persons, meanings, and values. Mental states possess aboutness. They're directed toward things beyond themselves. You can think about unicorns, contemplate justice, imagine tomorrow. This intentionality seems impossible in physical reality, which simply is. Yet from neurons firing emerges genuine thought, real meaning, actual understanding. The Jewish tradition revealed something profound. Our relationship with the divine mirrors relationships created through promises. A covenant isn't merely a command, it's a binding agreement where both parties assume obligations. God commands obedience, but also constrains himself, suggesting that the deepest reality isn't force, but responsibility, the capacity of free beings to bind themselves through commitments. From this emerges natural law, principles of fairness and reciprocity seemingly built into human reason. Watch children negotiating playground rules. They're discovering principles inherent to fair dealing. Rights and responsibility create spheres of personal sovereignty, fixed points enabling genuine negotiation. Beyond justice lies something entirely different. Affection, friendship, love. These involve unconditional giving that hopes for but doesn't demand reciprocity. You don't love your child because of a contract. These relationships point beyond covenant, toward the order of creation, where gift rather than exchange becomes fundamental. This distinction matters because human life constantly confronts experiences that contractual thinking cannot accommodate. Birth, death, falling in love, the arrival of children, these belong to creation's order, where being itself appears as gift rather than achievement. Our rituals dramatize this truth. What we have has been given, and the appropriate response is gratitude rather than negotiation. Music reveals something extraordinary about consciousness. When you hear a melody, you're not just processing sound waves, you're perceiving intentional movement with purpose and direction. Musical space has its own strange topology. Themes can return to their starting point while moving constantly upward, and certain harmonic structures cannot be flipped or transposed like their physical counterparts. This is movement of nothing in a space that is nowhere, yet it grips us with meaning. The difference between background music and genuine listening is the difference between preventing silence and letting silence speak. In true musical experience, silence becomes the canvas from which music emerges. The most eloquent moments in Beethoven's sonatas are often rests, pregnant pauses, where meaning accumulates in the absence of sound. Music offers pure aboutness without specific subject or object. It's not about anything in particular, yet somehow it contains all human life. A great string quartet possesses a soul that addresses us with authority, inviting us into a realm of fulfillment that transcends ordinary experience. Evolutionary explanations of music as maternal bonding or mate attraction ring hollow. They attempt to explain a phenomenon they haven't properly understood. Like religious experience, music creates sympathy between subjects without the encumbrance of an objective world. It's an icon of transcendence, a reminder that meaning can be real and powerful, even when it points to nothing we can name. When music moves us to tears or joy, we're experiencing the same overreaching intentionality that characterizes religious encounter, consciousness reaching beyond itself towards something that both is and isn't part of the ordinary world. We exist at boundaries, objects bound by physical laws, yet subjects capable of promises, responsibility, and recognizing worth. Science reveals the causal order enabling our existence, but we inhabit a realm of meanings and values it cannot capture. The sacred marks where these orders meet, where the why of existence emerges. Religion originated as death's remedy, refusing to accept departure as final through ancestor worship and permanent tombs. Yet the deepest religious insight transforms death itself. To meet death willingly, accepting it as return rather than annihilation, reveals that love and sacrifice connect us to something eternal, not endless time, but the timeless order of meaning that makes time comprehensible. We live in an age that has mastered explanation but lost understanding, mapping every neural pathway yet unable to explain why anything matters. Recovering the sacred isn't about rejecting science. It's about remembering we are persons, not just organisms. We encounter each other across thresholds where subject meets subject, where meaning appears without being reducible to mechanism. In that encounter lies everything human, love and sacrifice, promise and forgiveness, the recognition that existence itself is gift rather than accident.